Welcome to the Jack Kornfield Heart Wisdom Hour. We are delighted to share with you Jack's innate common sense wisdom and his clear, open heart. If you are interested in supporting Jack's podcast, go to BeHereNowNetwork.com/Jack.
Many previous years on the Monday night that's close to Christmas and New Year's, I'll do teachings that are holiday stories and beautiful stories of people caring for one another in this time. Tonight, because I've the last couple of months on Mondays, I've been telling some very long stories. A few of you might have been here. The long story, the Arthurian legend about what women want. If you don't know that story, you can listen to it. And then a long story last time, the myth of the Buddha's last teachings. I decided to continue in the vein of telling big stories, and we'll try to do it tonight and see if it fits with where we are. So tonight I want to tell the story of a bodhisattva named Vimalakirti, and bodhisattva is the Sanskrit word for a being who's committed to the service and care of all. Bodhi means awakened, and sattva means being, somebody who's fostering well-being and awakening for beings everywhere. And I kind of want to tell it because it's just about winter solstice in a couple of nights, two or three nights. And all around the world and culture, certainly in the northern hemisphere, there are festivals of light. There's Hanukkah, and there's Christmas, and there's Kwanzaa, and there's all kinds of other festivals. And often, they're also mythological. In fact, you know, there are lots of myths, virgin births and kings and, you know, coming in from the desert and children being born in mangers, or, you know, people who can then grow up and walk on water and turn, you know, the loaves and the fishes multiply and things like that. So it's a time of something bigger than just our ordinary way of seeing things. And I remember being at the top of Mount Tamalpais some years ago when there was a transit of the planet Venus across the face of the sun. And there were a number of people up there with some really big telescopes. And I loved looking in the biggest telescope, and there was the fiery ball of the sun. You could see all the kind of fiery plumes and things like that, and there was this little dark round marble, you know, that over the course of a couple of hours slowly moved across the face of this great glowing sun star. It was pretty small, just about the size of the Earth. And I had this feeling that, like that one going around, we're on another one of those going around taking our ride. And it's actually pretty small compared to the vastness of our star, not to speak of the whole solar system. And so there's something about the turning of the seasons and the winter solstice that's an invitation to vastness, and an invitation. The question is not just the future of humanity, but the presence of eternity, that there's something timeless. And remember being as a kid, I used to lie down on the grass in a starry night. It was a fun thing to do and look at the stars. But I would imagine that I was on the bottom of the Earth, stuck on like a magnet, you know, because it is, gravity is a magnet, and that I was looking down into the sea of stars, and it gave a little kind of excitement to it, you know, not falling down into it. But here we are, you know, on this little blue-green globe circling the sun, and there's something really mysterious that's asked of us to awaken to. So this story about Vimalakirti, who is a bodhisattva. Bodhisattvas basically make the vow to serve or to awaken all beings. If you're in a Zen center, every time you sit, you get in the proper posture and you often begin, sentient beings are numberless, I vow to save them all. And then you meditate. So your meditation is to serve them all. Now there's a little problem you may notice, and that is even if you take such a vow, the sentient beings you live with, for example, don't want to be saved by you. You may have noticed that. So it has to have some other meaning than that. And here's the Dalai Lama's vow. He wakes up in the morning from Shantideva, and in his morning prayers, may I be a boat, a raft, a bridge for all beings to cross the flood. May I be a resting place for the weary. May I be food for the hungry. May I be medicine for all who are sick. May I be a lamp in the darkness for those who are lost. And may I do so as long as earth and sky and galaxies exist. Until all are enlightened, I vow to be here to serve them all. Some little vow like that. Right? But you can hear in this an imagination of what's possible for us as human beings that's a lot bigger than your to-do list or Christmas shopping or holiday shopping or things, all of which are totally fine. But the turning of the season says there's something bigger, this mystery that we've been born into as a human being, your human incarnation, to pay attention to. And so this particular teaching, and I'll talk about it from the text of Vimalakirti, is a Mahayana sutra or text. And it's filled with story and humor and satire and poetry and magic and wisdom. And it has a whole mythological side to it. And Mahayana, especially these kind of Zen texts and so forth, it's a little bit of a reaction to the rigidity that had grown in Buddhist teachings over some centuries, the lists of the three characteristics and the four noble truths and the five spiritual faculties and the six perfections and the seven factors of enlightenment. Everybody trying to do things cookie cutter to get enlightened, the Eightfold Path, you know. And it's sort of like when Bob Dylan picked up an electric guitar and said, forget that folk stuff. We're going to do it straight out and direct. The Mahayana text in some way said, or Zen says, you don't need those lists. We're going to have a whole different set of teachings that's vast and bigger and opens your mind in ways that have gotten rigid over these last number of centuries. And we want to offer the highest possible teachings. And in a way, they are, as you'll hear, they're tremendously imaginative. And you might say, well, what good is imagination? Robert Desnos was a celebrated French poet who joined the resistance during the Nazi occupation, worked underground for a long time, and then finally was captured and sent to the concentration camps. And one day, he was sent first to a kind of collection point before being in the concentration camp where people were being killed, where they were being gassed. And a whole group of Desnos and a whole group of people who'd been gathered up, other former resistance fighters and so forth, were put in the back of a big truck and taken over to one of the concentration camps where people were being slaughtered or killed. And they all got out of the truck. People were, as you can imagine, already tired and emaciated, but now facing death, terribly bewildered and shocked and so forth. And Desnos kind of pushed his way to the front of the line. And then he grabbed the hand of the man in the front of the line and looked at it and said, wow, I'm so excited for you. You're going to live a long life. I can see it. you're going to have three more children, a beautiful wife, wealth, so fantastic, so wonderful. He grabbed another person's hand and started reading their palm and talking about all these things that were possible that were going to happen. And another and another, and the guards got kind of confused. Who is this guy at the front of the line reading palms? And then he turned around and he started reading the palms of the guards. When this war is over, you're going to have a big farm and you're going to have all these things. And he went on and on. And pretty soon everybody was smiling. You know, this is not what was expected. They all thought they were going to their death. And even the guards got confused. And by the time he finished reading their palms, they said, yeah, get back in your truck. You go back. And they didn't end up going into the gas chamber or wherever they were supposed to go. Everybody was astonished. Basically, when you're in trouble, do something really strange, you know. And it can help you. But it also says something about imagination, that even in the most difficult times, it's possible to see something much bigger. I mean, if we could take it's a nice space in here, but if we could take the roof off, you know, blow the clouds away and see all the stars, I mean, that's what you want in a temple, actually. So we need to be able to envision another world. A world that's not ruled as much by greed or hatred or fear, that doesn't have the kind of injustice and inequality and continuing racism and, you know, the difficulties and dangers of climate change and so forth. And it won't change unless we can envision this. We have to envision that this is possible for us as humans, and it is. We have all this outer technology that's developed. I mean, who would have imagined that you could have, you know, the Great Library of Alexandria in your pocket along with 2.7 million cat videos, right? And at the same time, the outer developments of technology now have to be matched by inner development of humanity. We're a nation of nuclear giants, said the Joint Chiefs of Staff, nuclear giants and ethical infants. And so that's the big task for us, to imagine another way of being. So, once upon a time, when you were somewhat younger than you are now, the Buddha was teaching in Vaisali. Let me see, where do I have this text? And he was teaching in the garden of Ambapali, attended by a gathering of 8,000 monks and nuns, all who were enlightened. They were calm and dignified like royal elephants, and surrounding them were 32,000 bodhisattvas, spiritual healers from all the great, you know, traditions and worlds. And when they had all gathered there, and the Buddha was expounding the teachings of the compassionate heart in every circumstance and liberation, then the Lichavis, which was one of the groups that lived in that area, with their greatest bodhisattva, Ratnakara, arrived, 500 youth behind him, all these young people, each holding a parasol made of 7 kinds of jewels, and they approached the Buddha and bowed down and asked for teachings after circling a few times. And when these were laid down, then, by the miraculous power of the Buddha, they were transformed into a single parasol, a canopy so great that it formed the covering for 1 billion galaxies, quite large. And the surface of this 1 billion galaxy was reflected in the interior of this precious canopy, where the total contents of the cosmos could be seen, limitless mansions of suns and moons and stellar bodies and every kind of being that exists across the universe. That was the vision and power of the Buddha. So you can see we're not in regular time anymore here, right? And then the Lichavi Ratnakara, who said, pure are your eyes and pure is your thought, immeasurable is your virtue, and all that the Buddha sees can be seen with the eyes of holiness, can be seen with beauty. And so the image of surrounding the universe with this parasol is really to see that of jewels, that there's beauty everywhere around us. Thomas Merton, if you go into the center of Louisville, Kentucky, there's a placard that's there at 4th Street that celebrates a passage where Thomas Merton came out of years as a Christian contemplative and was walking down the street and then had this revelation that everyone he passed, he said, was shining like the sun. He said, I could see a secret beauty born in them behind every eye that's inviolable and untouchable. And he said, the only problem with seeing this way is that you want to fall down and worship each one as they go by. And, you know, there are all these kind of roadside billboards and signs and national historic markers. This is the only historic marker I know for a mystical experience in the U.S. But it's like Allen Ginsberg's code, a footnote to Howell, where he says, holy, 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 the world is holy. This whole world, holy, the skyscrapers and the pavements and the cafeteria filled with the millions, holy, the mysterious rivers of tears under the streets, all of it is holy, has this vision of the sacredness of life under this great canopy. So this is where the teaching begins. And the thing is that we do know this in some way. I can remember coming out of a long retreat or finishing. I did some study with the remarkable shaman Don Jose Rios, who was at that time 103 years old. He was one of the great shamans of the Huichol Indians of the Huichol Sierras of Mexico. And I did some peyote ceremonies with him. And we sit up all night and shake our rattles and, you know, trip out, whatever, and do our chanting. And then I became a redwood tree and I became a salmon and so forth. And I remember the morning when the sun rose that everything sparkled like it was a jewel. And you all know this. This isn't just something that's fictional or that's, you know, drug-induced. It's the reality. We live in this mystery that's shining. It's what Thomas Merton saw. He said, there I was in the monastery looking for that which is holy, and I needed to walk down the shopping street in Louisville, and then I saw it. And that's really what it means in the turning of the seasons, to see with a different kind of light. So here's the Buddha offering his teachings. And then under this great parasol where we can see the beauty of life as it is that we are participating in. Oops. Then what happens is that, where are we? The Buddha hears that a certain bodhisattva named Vimalakirti, who is a lay person, he's not a monk or a nun, is ill. And he wants to send all the great enlightened disciples to go and take care of him. This is one of the tasks of someone who awakens, is that you care for the world and you care for those who need care. So he turns to all these around him, the enlightened ones around him, and he says, would you go and attend to Vimalakirti and see what he needs on my behalf? Because what we know is that he's a remarkable being. He's a lay person who lives with the pure heart of a monastic. He's appears to be adorned with ornaments, yet he's endowed with, you know, the simplicity of a hermit. He seems to eat and drink, and yet his nourishment really comes in the heart of meditation. It goes on. And yet, he's willing to enter the world to bring the spirit of love to every corner of the universe. And so he's decided to live his life as a lay person. He goes into the casinos and he teaches people about not being caught in attachment. That's the realm of the hungry ghost known as Las Vegas, right? He goes into the cabarets and into the bordellos, and he teaches people about sacred connection. He demonstrates freedom, and he's not afraid to go anywhere. But he's ill now, so you have to go and take care of him. And And it goes on to say, he deliberately made himself ill so that others would come and take care of him. And I remember, I don't know how many of you saw the Mr. Rogers movie, but if you didn't see it, it's really kind of wonderful. And I had mistakenly said the other day that it was Mr. Rogers had said something, but it turns out it was Mr. Rogers' mother who had said this. But she said to him, when there's a tragedy or a difficulty in this world, an earthquake, a tsunami, a hurricane as they had in Houston and so forth, don't pay attention to the suffering so much. I mean, we need to. But instead, look for the helpers. And there you are, whether it's an earthquake or whether it's the fires or whatever, and you start to see people rushing in from every side, the firefighters and the medical people, or in the, you know, in Texas, it was the people in their airboats coming from Louisiana and Mississippi saying, you know, we will go and we'll get the people who are on the roofs and we'll get the people whose pets are lost and so forth. And there's this outpouring of love that happens when we're in trouble. And this is Vimalakirti deliberately making himself appear sick so that he constellates or brings forth the love that's there, and then he can teach people. And part of what's true about this is that Vimalakirti deliberately turning himself toward that which is difficult. Anybody in this room not have difficulties? Please raise your hand. You can have your, whatever it is, $15 back, right? It's part of human incarnation. It's part of what we are. And so we can either run from it, or we can turn toward it, and turn toward it in a way that in some fashion ennobles us. This is from Zen teacher Kalfried Durkheim. He says, the person who's really on the way, when they fall upon hard times in the world, will not as a consequence turn to those friends who offer refuge and comfort and encourage their old self to survive. Rather, they'll seek out someone who will faithfully and inexorably help them to risk themselves so that they may endure the difficulty and pass courageously through it. Only to the extent that a person exposes themselves over and over to annihilation can that which is indestructible be found within them. In this daring lies dignity and the spirit of true awakening. And so if one wants to discover the great heart of compassion, to break the heart open, really, if one wants to discover your own dignity and courage, instead of running away or being in denial, which our culture fancies is a good way to deal with stuff in the world, unfortunately, politically, you actually turn toward in your own life and you trust that your heart is big enough to hold it all. When I teach, I carry sometimes a picture. This is Vedran Smolovic, who was the cellist of Sarajevo in the Balkan War when Bosnia and Serbia and so forth were at war, Croatia. Sarajevo was besieged for 3 years. Beautiful city. There was mortar fire and rocket and so forth. No one could get in and out except some UN helicopters. And people would be killed by the mortar fire. And Vedran, who was a cellist in the National Symphony, would put on his tux, take a little folding chair, and the next day go out to where the mortar had struck, and he would play this beautiful music so the people of the city wouldn't give up hope. This picture is him playing in the bombed-out National Library of Sarajevo. So what do we do in these times? And I think about it, and I guess I have to get real with you. Trudy and I went down, my beloved Trudy, and I went down to Tijuana to visit some of the two largest migrant shelters there, both to bring clothes and things that people could use. And we went partly because one of the teachers she'd trained at Inside LA ran a group there for both men's shelter and women's shelter. And in the best of the shelters, they also help some of the men get work, even temporary work in Tijuana. They had wraparound services of some legal services and health services and planning what will happen if you do go or if you don't cross the border, what are your possibilities, and then here's some work you can do for the couple of months that you can stay here. And it was amazing. There was a sense of dignity and empowerment because they were being treated respectfully. But here's the tough poem written 2 days ago, or a few days ago, by Gustavo Barahona Lopez. Every day I open class with a morning circle. 19, 7, and 8-year-olds sit on a colorful rug, talk about their favorite color, ideal superpowers, how they feel or who they'll be when they grow up. At recess, I read about a 7-year-old who died in Border Patrol custody after navigating the New Mexican desert. Her name is Jacqueline Calmaquin. I begin to wonder, did she make walking through the desert a game? Count the number of cacti? Make messages with stones in the sand? I wonder if she went to school. Did she have to leave midway through the year to work with the strawberry fields, you know, or water the donkeys like my father? I imagine her in my classroom. Would she color desert sunrises, or would the deep sunset reds and oranges be her inspiration? I wonder if she knew where she was going. What was America to her? I wonder if she spoke Quiche or English or Spanish or Mom. I wonder if she knew her times tables. What is 15,000 children times two parents in a different detention facility? My students know any number of bottles of water times Border Patrol equals zero. Did she know the definition of terror, or did she call it fear? The not knowing tears. Who was she? Who would she have become? Who have we lost? And I read it because this is our children. And not just to have an emotional moment, but actually to say, if you were to reflect for her, and whatever your politics, whatever your point of view about immigration and so forth, the reality is that there are these people in this circumstance. And the international governments and so forth around the world, 70 million refugees, have not really dealt with it. And if you could do something in these next weeks, one small gesture to give something, you know, to call your representative, to whatever it happens to be, if you could do one little thing as a gift to those children or to those who are in that bardo in between things, why not do that as part of the things you do in this turning of the year? Really think about it. What would that be? Because we get insulated, and we also get overwhelmed because there's so much. What do we do? Climate change. What do we do? Syria. What do we do? You know, Darfur is still happening. What do we do about homelessness? And they almost want you to feel like you can't do anything. It's a lie. It's completely untrue. You have agency, you have gifts, and you have the capacity to reach your hand out and mend some part of the world. And I don't think anything else really satisfies our soul as much as that. So here we are with Vimalakirti, and he decides to make himself sick after going to the, you know, bordellos and the casinos and everything else, and bring all those healers together. But when he makes himself sick, he also gives some teachings about how it's all a dream. Now, when you're sick, it doesn't feel like a dream. It feels like a bad dream, right? It's not like a star at dawn and a flash of lightning in a summer cloud. But yet he offers a teaching that says, who are we really? I was recently with Ram Dass in Hawaii teaching. Ram Dass is now 87 in a wheelchair. Trudy and I went to join him and Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg, our dear friends, to teach together. And Ram Dass mostly teaches love now. He says, I love everything. I love you and you and you. I love the whole group. Every single one of you, you know, and your children and your parents, however they treated you, I still love them, you know. And on his big altar where he has, you know, Kuan Yin and the Buddha and Mother Mary and his Maharaji, his guru, and, you know, Gandhi and 100 other figures. He used to have Dick Cheney in the middle. Now it's, the image has been replaced by Donald Trump. You know, and he says, of course, I love the walls and the ceilings and the lights, you know, and the shoes that are out there. In fact, he said, I love this dirty carpet. Somebody, one of his students, got a piece of that dirty carpet and put it in a gold frame and sent it to him, said, put this on your altar, right? Which he did, next to the picture of his guru. But anyway, we're sitting with Ram Dass. And Trudy asked him, are you in much pain these days? Knowing that it was pretty much so. He's been in a wheelchair for 20 years. And he's a different kind of infection. So, yeah, my feet, this is going on. And she knew that. And how about, you know, this? Yeah, that hurts. And do you have pain there? Oh, yeah. And then he paused for a minute. He looked, smiled, this kind of amazing smile. And he said, I love my pain. And it wasn't a masochistic kind of thing at all. It was just, it was like, I love life. I love everything. And there's this kind of field around him that says, who you are is not your body. As Thich Nhat Hanh said, and he's 90 years old in his wheelchair after a stroke. This body is not me. You can honor it and love it and care for it, but I'm not limited by this body. I'm life without boundaries. I've never been born, and I've never died. Look at the sky and the ocean filled with stars. Since before time, I am them. I've been free. Birth and death are only doors through which our spirits pass, sacred thresholds on our journey. Birth and death are the game of hide and seek. Come and hold my hand, and we'll meet again and again in this dance. So this is where Vimalakirti is coming from. All these people are visiting him sick, and he's giving a whole different level of teachings. And it's very playful, the way he teaches. But this group of enlightened disciples of the Buddha don't want to go visit Vimalakirti because he's given them a hard time every time they go and talk with him. They'll sit with him, and he'll ask them for their teachings. They'll tell them some beautiful teachings, and he'll say, well, not quite right. And then he'll correct them and say, this is still kind of dualistic. So I'll give you an example. Ananda, the Buddha's beloved attendant, and one of the people that in the stories is supposed to be the most kind-hearted person. The Buddha himself had gotten sick, and it seemed that going out and getting some milk would be a good thing to help the Buddha. So Ananda goes out with his alms bowl, and in some cases, if you're asked by householders, is there anything I can offer you, Ananda would say, yes, you could give me some milk for the Blessed One. So he goes through the town, and Vimalakirti sees him and says, what are you doing? He said, I'm out to get milk for the Buddha who has an illness, and I think it will help. And Vimalakirti says, an illness? Reverend Ananda, the body of the Buddha is like diamonds. It's beyond good and evil, beyond sick and well. How could disease or discomfort touch such an awakened one? You insult him by going out for milk. You have to understand true liberation is not bound by these small concepts of body and healing and sickness. That's all duality. Vimalakirti is a non-dual kind of guy. And Ananda shrinks back and says, all right, I take your point, but what am I to do? You know, it may all be non-dual, but what am I to do? And he goes on, he says, but the Buddha is like the vast sky and the shining stars. How could you get milk for that? You know, you don't understand what you're doing in this world. Ananda feels confused and sad, and then all of a sudden the Buddha in his mind hears this conversation, and he says, Ananda, the householder of Vimalakirti speaks to you of deep truth, yes. Nevertheless, since the Buddha has appeared in this time as a human being with the difficulties that humans have, he teaches the world by acting lowly and humble, and therefore, Ananda, do not be ashamed and go and get me some milk. And what you can hear in this, it's actually quite playful. The whole thing is playful. Like, what level do you want to dance on? You know, as Ram Dass likes to say, you need to remember your Buddha nature and your social security number. And you kind of have to have them both in your heart at the same time. And I remember there were some big demonstrations during Occupy that happened in Oakland. And our dear friends in Meditation Center, our sister, brother Meditation Center, the East Bay Meditation Center in Oakland, which is the single most diverse Dharma center I know on the planet. It's really quite wonderful and amazing. Anyway, they were close to downtown. And so they were out there with everybody Occupy. And because it was all happening and there was also some concern about, how do we say it, the inequalities of our current financial system, the way that it is. There were some demonstrators at some of the big banks, and the banks closed their doors for that time when the demonstrations were happening. The people were still onside doing their work somewhat, but the doors were closed, but it's all glass there. And so they went outside the bank, the closest big bank to them, and they got a big stack of $1 bills, and they stood by the door of the bank, and they started giving money to everybody that walked up, just to mess with the minds of the people inside the bank. You come to the bank for money here. We should share it. And this is a little bit of the spirit of Vimalakirti. He basically messes with you until you go, okay, I surrender. I see that there's something bigger that I have to pay attention to, and you can be playful with it as well. So, they go to see Vimalakirti, or they're about to go to see Vimalakirti. They haven't even gone there yet. And one of them says, well, you know, where does he reside and how does he sit? And they said, well, the seat that he takes, and there's a long description of the kind of seat that Vimalakirti takes, but the passage that I love the most is where Vimalakirti sits on the seat of love, because it expands to all beings. And he rises up from the seat of love and he exudes or distributes the qualities of love to all that he touches. So he sits on the seat of love. And, you know, here we are coming to practice together as we do. And the invitation to sit with loving awareness and attend to your own breath, and to the emotions that arise, your sadness and your joy and your longing and your love, to attend to the way your mind makes stories, and then to come back and live in the reality of the present more fully, not so lost in those, so that you can be here for the person in front of you and the way that you drive and the things that you tend in your work, and the things that you care about in the world, including yourself. What is your seat? Is it a seat of love? You know, and here you learn these trainings, not just for yourself, but also to see what it means to live with an awakened heart. So someone who sits here wrote me a story of a shipyard he works with in Seattle. Typically there are 700 people working at the yard. Twice a week, he leads a group sit, where anyone in the yard and the company can meditate, followed by a talking stick check-in circle. Racial and gender issues are being addressed. Now many of the trades start their shift with a short meditation and check-in. There are trees being planted in what was a desolate yard. It's spotless. It feels alive. Today, it's a much safer place to work, and as you might expect, more profitability since they've implemented this whole human dharma approach. All has taken place since last year, and so much has been gone on, and only by bringing a few of the seeds that I learned here in my retreat. I find it a really beautiful story. But, you know, what it says is that when you plant seeds, beautiful seeds, as Vimalakirti teaches, the world responds. I think it was Thoreau who said, convince me you have a seed there. You know, convince me you have a seed there, and I'm prepared to expect miracles. Because this is how it works. The seeds that we plant and we water are what will grow. So some of you know that Dennis Mukwege, if I say his name right, was a physician who gave a speech to the UN decrying the horror of mass rape in Congo. And he'd been tending a clinic, and women who'd been raped and women who had all kinds of other medical problems for quite a long time. And because Congo is in such conflict, at some point after he came to the UN, the gunman invaded his home and attempted or threatened to kill him and his wife and daughters. He had guards who stopped them, and he left the Congo shortly thereafter. And the poor women who lived all around the clinic sold their harvest and bought him a plane ticket to come back. And they said, you know, you've made our life livable and bearable, and we know that you feel that you're in danger. We will do what we can to protect you, and we're going to give of the little bit that we have, all of us, to make sure that you're part of our community. And it says something like in this text that if you live on the seed of love and if you plant those seeds, it's not just you, but something really mysterious happens in the world around you. And this is quite possible for all of us. So then they do go to visit Vimalakirti to console the invalid, as it said. And one of the greatest of the disciples, Manjushri, goes and asks Vimalakirti where he's been, and Vimalakirti says, well, I've been everywhere, you know, to the hell realms and the realm of the jealous gods. That's, by the way, Washington, D.C. You know, the hell realms, I'm sorry to say, are in Darfur and Syria, but some other places that we know that are closer as well. I've been to all of those places. And they come in, and then one of the great enlightened people, monks around the Buddha, but these are all foils in this. One of his wisest disciples, Sariputra, comes in and says, where can we sit? There are no chairs. And Vimalakirti looks at him, sort of teasing him, and says, get the chairs. Did you come here for the sake of the Dharma, or did you come for the sake of a chair? What are you looking for? And Sariputta says, of course, the Dharma. You know, again, there's this sort of little back and forth. And then the Vimalakirti says, well, where are the best chairs in the great galaxies? And this one of the disciples said, oh, this Buddha who lives over there has magnificent thrones that are, you know, 84,000 feet high, and they're covered with jewels and lotuses and peacock feathers and all these things. And he says, let there be chairs. And then by his own magic, the room expands so that 100,000 enlightened beings from all the galaxies around gather and sit in those chairs, along with a few chairs for the guests who've arrived. So again, it really speaks to the possibility of imagination, but also the generosity of spirit, that you may not have anything, but if you open your mind and your heart when someone comes in, that makes the magic. It doesn't matter if they sit on the floor. If the heart and mind is open, people sit in the midst of something that's beautiful and magnificent. And then, let me see, here's the next little thing that happens. So the room expands to an inconceivably large size, and all these, you know, hundreds of thousands of enlightened beings on these vast thrones are seated around watching the you know, reality show or whatever it is, the dialogue. And then Vimalakirti is saying, this is nothing. He goes on, Reverend Sariputra, the Bodhisattva who lives in inconceivable liberation, the liberation of all beings, can pour into a single pore of his skin all the waters of the four great oceans without injuring the water animals such as fish, tortoises, crocodiles, frogs, and other creatures. Without them even being aware of a problem, the whole operation is visible without any injury or disturbance to the frogs and the alligators and all such things. Now, such a bodhisattva can reach his right hand and pick up a whole galaxy like this and open it for you to see and understand and bring illumination to all the beings that are there. So this is the kind of story that it is, right? So Sariputra says, okay, I see that you're someone of some great possibilities, but why is this? What is this teaching us? Poem from Mary Oliver. What can I say that I've not said before? So I'll say it again. The leaf has a song in it. Stone is the face of patience. Inside the river, there's an unfinished story, and you are somewhere in it, and it will never end until all ends. Take your busy heart to the art museum and the Chamber of Commerce, but take it also to the forest and the hills. The song you heard singing in the leaf when you were a child is singing still. I'm of years lived, so far, 74, and the leaf is still singing. And so she's speaking to the mystery that Vimalakirti is teaching, that when you see rightly, as the poet Hafez says, when you see rightly, the leaves on the trees become like pages in the holy books. And that you don't have to look any further than where you are to see that which is sacred and mysterious. I mean, how did we get into this human life? You think you're your body? Come on. You know, it changes. You have to take care of it. You rent it like Avis, right? You got to turn it in at some point. But yes, you use it. But, I mean, it's not who we are. There's a spirit that was born into you and that will leave your body when you die. You'll see. You wait. All right? Float out of your body, light, you know, all that stuff. It happens to be true. You don't have to believe me, but when it happens, remember I told you. You know? But you're not just this body, and you're not just the conditioning, you know, of your culture or your parents. I mean, those are really small potatoes. Yes, they can make a lot of suffering in different ways when we believe them. But then Vimalakirti is saying, don't believe that. Believe something so much greater and more magnificent about who you are and what this world is, and see it everywhere that you look. So then, two more things, let me see, and then we do our little ritual. A goddess who lives in the house there, another enlightened being, comes down to listen. Sariputra said, how long have you been here? And she says, timeless. I've been with Vimalakirti since the beginning. And then Sariputra says, well, you know, I'm glad that you're here. Have you received anything of benefit? And she said, oh, he gives awakening blessings to everyone. And then Sariputra says, but then why are you still in a woman's body? I mean, don't you have to be a man to be fully awakened? there is that teaching, you know, in some Buddhist things. And I remember Deepa Ma, who was this great woman, yogi and master that I studied with, quite an extraordinary being who'd mastered all the realms of meditation and compassion, loving kindness. She just was love. But she also had tremendous power. And her teacher, Manindra, who was also a teacher of mine, they were together at some point. And I mean, she was the kind of person, I never saw it. I kept wanting her to do something magic because her teacher said, oh, yeah, I've seen her walk through walls. I've seen her appear and disappear, do all these things that, you know, one reads about. Anyway, at one point he was teaching and he said, but you have to be a man to become a Buddha. You have to do that in a male body. And Deepa Ma said, yeah, I can do anything a man can do. So be quiet, you know. And it was really true. You could feel it. So in this, Sariputra is talking to her, and the goddess comes, and she covers his body with flower petals. She says, here, Sariputra. And he says, wait, I'm a monk. I shouldn't have these flower petals. And she says, you're so caught up on what's pure and what's impure. And I guess I'll read you. Let me see if I can find it here. This is a version not in there by my old friend Rick Fields, called the Short Sutra on the Meeting of the Buddha and the Goddess. And I read it because it's somehow a combination of something way beyond me too, you know. This is women's liberation on steroids, let us say, okay. Thus I have heard the Buddha was walking along the forest path, walking without arriving anywhere or any thought of arriving, and lotuses shining with morning dew miraculously appeared under every step, soft as silk between the toes of the Buddha. When suddenly out of the turquoise sky, dancing in front of his half-shut inward-looking eyes, shimmering like a rainbow or a spider's web, transparent as the dew on a lotus flower, the goddess appeared, quivering like a hummingbird in the air before him. She, for she was surely as she as the Buddha could see, clearly with his eye of discriminating wisdom, was mostly red in color, though when the light shifted, she flashed like a rainbow. She was naked except for the usual flower ornaments goddesses wear. Her long hair was deep blue, her two eyes fathomless pits of space, and her third eye a ring of fire. The Buddha folded his hands together and greeted the goddess thus, O goddess, why are you blocking my path? Before I saw you, I was happily going nowhere, and now I'm not sure where to go. You can go around me, said the goddess, twirling on her heels like a bird darting away, but just a little away, or you can come after me. This is my forest, too, and you can't pretend I'm not here. With that, the Buddha sat, supple as a snake, solid as a rock beneath a Bodhi tree that sprang full leaf to shade him. Perhaps we should have a chat, he said. After years of arduous practice at the time of the morning star, I penetrated reality. And now, not so fast, Buddha. I am reality. The earth stood still. The oceans paused. The wind itself listened, and 1,000,000 arhats, bodhisattvas, dakinis magically appeared to hear what would happen in their conversation. I know I take my life in my hands, said the Buddha, but I am known as the fearless one, so here goes. And he and the goddess, without further words, exchanged glances. Light rays like sunbeams shot forth so bright that even Sariputra, the all-seeing one, had to turn away. And then they exchanged thoughts, and the illumination was bright as a diamond candle. And then they exchanged mind, and there was a great silence as vast as the universe that contains everything. And then they exchanged bodies and clothes, and the Buddha arose as the goddess, and the goddess arose as the Buddha, and so on back and forth for 100,000 kalpas of time. If you meet the Buddha, you meet the goddess. And if you meet the goddess, you meet the Buddha. Not only that, this, the Buddha is the goddess, and the goddess is the awakened one. And not only that, the Buddha is emptiness, and the goddess is bliss. The goddess is emptiness, and the Buddha is bliss. And this is what and what not you are, and it is true. So there was a little dialogue that happened there in the sutra between the goddess and, in this case, in that case, it was Sariputra, where she switched bodies with him. He was a little more reluctant than the Buddha, but she kind of did that little bit of a dance. And what it shows, in the deepest way, you know, is that all our ideas of purity and impurity and, you know, all the kind of judgments of the heart and who, all the notion of who's better and who's worse, all those kind of evaluations, they're really a limitation. And it's possible instead to live with the eyes of love, to see every being that you meet as the Buddha, some of them a little bit more caught and deluded. As Ram Dass says, he's put a variety of pictures in the middle of his altar. And I do my loving kindness practice, and I picture some of the despots of the world. And I include them, and I say, may you be free from hatred. May you be free from fear. May you be free from delusion. You know, may you too awaken the heart of love. And I can wish that for anybody. I can wish that for anybody. And so this text invites us to live in a different reality, and also to see this reality wherever we go, because people are serving one another. In even as we do this talk, there have been 10 million acts of goodness in the Bay Area. People cooking, you know, grilled cheese sandwiches for their children for dinner who really didn't want to eat the broccoli, right? And people stopping at the red lights so that you can safely pass through the green, or standing in line at the market in a civilized way so that other people who were there before them. We do this all the time. And we tend to focus on what's problematic. Poem by Laszlo Slomovitz. A man is running hard to catch the bus that just left. It's picking up speed, but he pulls even, running, and raps on its side, and a woman by the window yells to the driver, who stops and opens the accordion door, but the man does not get on. He points back to an old woman who's not run a step in a very long time, shuffling toward the bus. Nor does he leave until he's helped her up both steps, and then walks back slowly, still breathing hard from the fast run toward us, who are waiting for a different bus. What can a group of strangers like us do at a time like this? A time in its own way, like when Jesse Owens roared by them all in the Olympics, and everyone stood in the stadium and applauded. Gestures like that all the time from people. This is how we can live. And this is really what Vimalakirti points to. Again, from Mary Oliver. I think of the Buddha's last day. Every morning as the east begins to tear off its many clouds of darkness and send up the first signal, a white fan streaked with pink and violet and green. An old man, he laid down between two sal trees. He might have said anything, knowing it was his final hour. The light burns upward and settles over the field. Around him, the villagers gathered and stretched forward to listen. No doubt, he thought of everything that happened in his vast and difficult life. Slowly, beneath the branches, he raised his head and looked into the face of that expectant crowd. Make of yourself a light, he said as his last words. Make of yourself a light.